Hey guys, welcome back to a new episode of Those Murder Girls podcast. I am your host, Raina. Thank you guys so much for joining me today. I wanted to start today's show off with a few things. First of all, I want to shout out our newest patrons, Maria and Beth. I thought about moving my shout outs to the end of the show, but you guys are the most important part, so I only found it fitting to make you guys the first part of my show. Thank you so much for your support. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com or buymeacoffee.com or PayPal using the email address murdergirls@thosemurdergirlspodcast.com. This show, again, you guys, is all about you. I love being here. I love that you love me being here. So, like I said last week, I want to continue to drop ad-free episodes every single week, and I can do that with your support and your generosity. So, thank you guys once again to everyone who has become a patron or who has sent in a PayPal donation. Next, you guys, I'm going to kick off new bonus content with a segment featuring your stories, whether it's like a hometown murder story or you being related to a serial killer or living next door to one, anybody who's had like active spirits in their house, maybe that messed with you guys growing up. I told my story way back when in one of the earlier episodes. And now I want to hear yours and I want to share the craziest ones with all of our listeners as some bonus content. So you have them, I need them. Send an email to murdergirls@thosemurdergirlspodcast.com. Okay, today's story begins just shy of 30 years ago when the body of a woman was found along a rural but busy highway in the unincorporated area of Gilroy, California. It was believed to have been there for at least a week. The year was 1992 when a woman nicknamed Blue Pacheco by the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department was discovered by a trucker an hour and a half south of San Francisco. Dressed in blue denim, the 40-something held no clues to her identity, and sadly, much of what was found of her were just bones and clothing. Only the obvious was known about her, left by her killer in the area of Dinosaur Point and El Toro along Highway 152. Authorities had believed that the woman had passed away of a drug overdose. Well, it was just last Wednesday, almost 30 years later, that Blue Pacheco's identity was learned. She was Patricia Skipple of Oregon, or Patsy as those who loved her would call her. The Sheriff's Department and their amazing team of dedicated team members have been working tirelessly on Blue Pacheco's case since 2019 when they brought it out to follow up on some leads. Born in May of 1948, Patsy was a blue-eyed nurse's aide, but most importantly, she was a mother of two. She was said to be a quiet person and a wonderful mother, who left her home one day in 1992 to go visit her mother and never arrived. As if her true identity being revealed after all these years wasn't a miracle in itself, the identity of her killer was also determined at the same time, both by genetic genealogy. The findings were made possible when Patsy's nephew Don and his sister released their Ancestry.com results into GEDmatch, which is a public site that law enforcement is able to use in their investigations. So when Don got the call from the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department asking him to release his results, he had no idea why, and the Sheriff's Department couldn't disclose anything because they were actively working on this investigation. And from there, the connection was made. Patsy had been one of the many victims of the infamous Happy Face Killer, not to be confused with the Smiley Face Killer, if you're a believer in that theory. The Happy Face Killer struck in 6 different states, killing 8, including Patsy, who was victim number 4. The Happy Face Killer was born a serial killer in British Columbia, April 1955. I mean, I don't know if he was actually born that way or not, but the things that he had been doing at a very young age, believe me to think he may have had been. And it probably didn't help that he didn't come from a solid background with morals and ethics or even very good genes. As you guys will see, and you can make the determination for yourself, Keith Jesperson was born 3rd of 5 children total, and he was often left out of all childhood activities by his siblings and his peers. Keith was forced to grow up a loner no matter how hard he tried to fit in. Transitioning into adolescence didn't help much as Keith was really large for his age, which made him a target for bullying. He wouldn't stop growing until he reached 6'7" and about 240 pounds. Keith grew up in an abusive and dysfunctional home, if that's what you can call it, with his parents Les and Gladys and his four siblings, that was until Les and Gladys eventually divorced. Both his mother and his father were abusive. Les was an alcoholic who had a lot of the same traits as his own father, which was Keith's grandfather. Neither men cared for or respected women, and they made that very obvious. At the age of 5, Keith admits to killing animals, birds, cats, dogs, whatever he can get his hands on, torturing them and eventually strangling them. This was his preferred method of killing, and he would never outgrow it. Keith often found himself in trouble for being mischievous, and also he had very violent behavior. Feeling like there's no one around him who really cared, Keith often acted out, perhaps trying to gain some sort of attention to himself. His father would give him attention, all right, physically abusing him every single chance he got. A book was written about Keith Jesperson called I, The Creation of a Serial Killer by Jack Olson, which I highly recommend. So in that book, Keith admits that the only time his father ever showed him any sort of love or that he was proud of him was when Keith would kill and torture animals. Something he says that he got a thrill from at a very young age, and that he always hoped to have that feeling while killing a human one day. So at 5 years old, he starts killing animals. So naturally, at 10, Keith would try to kill one of his best friends. Him and his friend Martin, the two had played all the time. They got in trouble together, and more often than not, Keith said that he found himself getting in trouble for things that Martin would do. Martin would push all the blame and punishment towards him, and eventually it started to take a toll on Keith. But instead of a good old-fashioned unfriending, like, I don't want to talk to you, I don't like you, you're not my friend anymore, Keith found the opportunity to make his fantasies a reality by killing Martin. And he'd never have to take the blame for Martin's shit again. So when Keith found the opportunity, he beat the shit out of Martin at the age of 10, you guys. But thankfully for both boys, Keith's dad intervened, breaking Martin free. Keith fully admitted his intentions that day. He said he wanted Martin dead. At 10 years old, he wanted his friend gone forever. That's just crazy. I remember my best friend at 10. She's still my friend today, and I would never want her gone, no matter how mad she made me. We were sisters. We fought all the time. But I guess that's the difference between Keith and I. He's a serial killer, and I'm not. Okay, so Keith's second attempt at killing a friend at the age of 10 years old came at a local swimming pool when Keith held this kid underwater until the kid passed out. Thankfully for the child, a lifeguard was nearby, intervened, pulled him from the water, and was able to save his life. Keith had also tried hunting his neighbors, shooting two of his neighbors with a gun, and also attacking a teacher by shooting him with a bow and arrow, with an arrow that was meant to, like, explode on contact. Keith remained a loner into his late teens, and finally entered into his first relationship when he was almost 20 years old, and he would go on to marry her. Rose Huck Jesperson and Keith would have 3 children together, and Keith knew early on that he would need a good job to support his growing family. You wouldn't think so, but Keith wasn't really the worst family man. He had went from being single through his teens to a whole lot of responsibility pretty quick, and he did okay at it all. Keith found a career as a long-haul trucker traveling cross-country. It was a tiresome job, and it had him away from home most of the time, but what was important to him is that it paid well and his family was well cared for. All was well at the Jesperson house until Rose began to get some strange phone calls that were coming in from different women asking for Keith one by one, all claiming to be his girlfriends. Obviously, this was kind of impossible because Rose thought to herself, well, I'm his wife, and I'm going to let each and every caller know. So these calls and claims came in at all hours, and it did a number on their marriage. And soon, her and the 3 children were packed up. The oldest child was 10 at the time, and they were on their way to Rose's parents' house in Spokane, Washington. And Rose and Keith would begin filing for divorce in about 1990 after 14 years of marriage. So feeling desperate with some past emotions and insecurities resurfacing, Keith decided that he was going to work on it himself and work towards a goal that he had had for quite some time. And I question this goal because he started the training and employment process for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and he actually scored quite well until a physical exercise would lead to a disqualifying injury. Which, thank goodness that occurred, because this guy had killer tendencies since he was a child and he had fascinated about killing as an adult. So I'm pretty sure this guy was just trying to hide behind the badge so he could carry out his crimes and no one would even suspect him. So after his injury healed, it was back to long-haul trucking and things were about to get bad. Keith, now a single man, felt as free as ever to live life on his terms in between visits with his kids when work would bring him back into town. After a failed marriage and a failed career in law enforcement, the urges to kill were creeping back into Keith's psyche, and it seemed to be the only thing that he had any control over. And so the beginning of a deadly wave of killings would span across the U.S., killings that would have possibly been solved if not for a set of very strange circumstances. And I mean, the most unbelievable circumstances you guys will probably ever hear in a case of a serial killer. It's like Keith's entire life was made for a Lifetime movie, which actually exists, and it stars David Arquette, which I really want to watch because David Arquette is so sweet. I can't imagine him playing a serial killer. He's Dewey. Come on now. So Keith would love to frequent this bar and billiard spot in Portland, Oregon, where he was living, when he had the chance. So on a particular night in January 1990, a woman by the name of Tanja Bennett would meet tall, handsome Keith, and the two would hit off a little conversation. Tanja had had an oxygen deprivation accident, which caused brain damage, leaving her at a below average mental capacity, which is important to mention because she wasn't fully aware of the warnings that others at the bar were giving her when they told her to steer clear of the man who sometimes came in acting a little odd. Tanja could not have been at the wrong place at any more of a wrong time when she met Keith, because he wasn't just the handsome face that she saw. He was looking, actually, I'll say hunting, for his first human kill that night. Keith would end up leaving the bar, trying to fight the urges to kill, but would eventually make his way back to the bar, having some conversations with Tanja and taking her back home with him. The two hooked up in Keith's rented bedroom, and it was all good until she was unsatisfied with the situation in bed. She makes the mistake of telling Keith to hurry up and finish so they could just be done. Like, she was done, she was over it, she just didn't want what was going on anymore. At that moment, Keith's personality just flips. He was done. Keith was done with Tanja. He began beating her in the face with his bare hands over and over and over again until she literally lay in his bed completely unrecognizable. Keith would admit in that book by Jack Olson that he did everything in his power to kill Tanja, but she was a strong-willed woman who was eager to live and just wouldn't go. He tried choking her for minutes, he said, with his hands. He tried a chokehold and nothing would work. She would eventually pass away in his room. And at that point, Keith cleaned himself up, made his way back to the bar, ordering drinks just like normal at an attempt to establish an alibi. He eventually made his way back home, putting Tanja in his car and taking her to an overlook where he dumped her and where she would stay until she was discovered just a few days later. This is where shit gets crazy. I mean, this whole thing is crazy and it's so uncalled for, but you guys know what I mean. So Tanja's killing was all over the news, and someone with a sick plan was watching very closely. Her name was Laverne Pavlinak. Oh, Laverne, how you are about to do way more damage than you ever set out to. So Laverne was a mother of three, desperate to be freed from an abusive relationship that she had claimed to be stuck in. She met up with police, telling them a wild tale of kidnapping, rape, and murder, and how he was going to get away with it unless they did something about it. Laverne had been with her boyfriend, John Sosnowski, who was 18 years older than her for years and years and years, and the relationship was ugly. Some say that the stresses in the relationship that Laverne was living through led to the actions that were about to unfold. Laverne had claimed that she met her boyfriend John for some drinks at a bar, and when she arrived, she overheard John talking to another bar patron about a murder he had committed, and not just any murder. Laverne said it was the murder of Tonja Bennett. Laverne claimed to know intimate details about the murder, even taking investigators out to the area where she was dumped, which, might I note, was widely publicized on TV. But Laverne was able to point out different spots that the investigators had questions about. And at one point or another, and this is huge, police had left Laverne in some sort of area or space. I'm guessing it was an interrogation room, with the official police report where she was able to read it. So when she was alone, Laverne took the opportunity to read as much as the report that she could, and then she turned around and used all that information in her own false confession. So investigators didn't jump at the opportunity to arrest John for the murder because I think their spidey senses thought that something weird was up with Laverne. So another round of questioning brought investigators to Laverne, and Laverne said that she could not let the chances of John not being arrested and put away for hopefully the rest of his life get away from her. So Laverne tells police that what she's saying is the truth and it's nothing but the truth, and she knows all of it is a fact because in actuality, she was there the night that Tonja was killed. Laverne is now saying that she was there when Tonja was killed and she helped, saying that John had forced her to participate in all aspects of the murder. So Laverne details picking up Tonja and John from the bar and driving out to a scenic outlook along the Columbia River Gorge in Oregon. So Laverne says that she recalls John and Tonja just horsing around, playing around in the car when things quickly escalated to a violent struggle. She said from there, John had raped Tonja and eventually murdered her. But Laverne said that she actually believes that she was responsible for the murder because she was holding the rope that was tied around Tonja's neck, and she said that she felt like she was pulling on it a little too hard, and that's how Tonja had died. Laverne had even planted evidence that she read about in that police report. Laverne knew that Tonja's jeans were missing the zipper and button part because in an attempt to get rid of fingerprints, the murderer had cut that section of the fly off of her pants. So Laverne had done the same thing to another pair of jeans, giving it to police saying that it belonged to Tonja's jeans. Laverne had even planted a purse in the trunk of John's car, claiming that it belonged to Tonja. But neither one of these pieces of evidence quite matched up to the victim's belongings. When questioned, John had strongly denied any involvement in the murder, but strangely, John had given some information regarding somebody that he knew was responsible for the murder, which is crazy because he knew damn well that that person was not responsible for the murder, let alone himself, so why would he even go there? These two people are absolutely nuts. Police had their suspicions about both John and Laverne, and they were just wanting to catch some solid evidence or a confession or criminating statements from John just to either put the whole investigation in this direction to rest or make an arrest. So they planted a recording device inside of Laverne and John's home, but the only thing that they were able to get from that were loads of statements from Laverne actually trying to brainwash John into believing that he was the actual killer. This is crazy. Laverne had made claims in the past that not only was John Tonja's actual killer, but he was a bank robber too, and she was constantly contacting his probation officer to complain about his heavy drinking and his behavior, hoping that they would just lock him up. But it didn't work, so she says that she had no choice but to take these extreme measures and try to frame him for the murder. The couple was eventually arrested after John had failed a polygraph test, and by the end of their trials, prosecutors were able to charge both of them with the murder. John got a life sentence, and Laverne, you know, his delusional accomplice in all of this, got 10 years. So that kind of backfired on her. She wanted John in jail, but she ends up behind bars because she had incriminated herself in a desperate attempt to let the police know, like, hey, I know that this is fact. I was with John, actually, and I helped him. He forced me to. So now her ass is locked up, too. So she's locked up, and she's shocked, and she's scared. And she is just doing everything she can to please be heard out. She wants somebody to listen to her. She wants to admit all of her lies. She wants to explain everything. But she was obviously unable to talk her way out of what she had gotten herself into and John. So now for another weird twist. Just like Laverne had been watching Tonja's murder investigation unfold on TV, Keith Jesperson, the actual killer, was doing the same as he watched John and Laverne be charged for Tonja's murder. Keith himself says that he watched all of this unfold in complete horror as this strange lady was seen on local news walking investigators through the wooded area where he actually had dumped Tonja's body. He said that he was watching so confused, like, what the hell? He began to actually question his own actions of that night. Like, did I really kill her? Or did they? Like, where is this story coming from? What the hell is going on? No, I killed her. I know I did. So with all the media attention on this murder case, Keith actually starts to get super pissed. He's like, why is this couple getting all the attention for this murder that I committed? Keith started leaving written confessions in random places, including a rest stop restroom, and he also sent confession letters to investigators and the media with solid proof that he was the actual killer, detailing the murder in only a way a killer could. In the letters that Keith was writing, he was telling the readers that he was actively still killing. And then he would give details about past crimes. He would give a lot of information that was actual fact, except for his name, because he obviously enjoyed the chase. Each of his confessions were signed with a happy face, and that is how the happy face serial killer was born. So after the murder of Tonja came another in 1992, a woman found in Blythe, California. Sadly, she still remains a Jane Doe today. But hopefully DNA will bring her identity back to her in the near future. Keith's third victim was Cynthia Rose, a 32-year-old found in Turlock, California, September 1992. Keith coldly admits to killing her over a parking space. Then followed Lori Ann Pentland, 26, found in November 1992 in Salem, Oregon. Keith and her had spent a very short time together one evening when Lori Ann was kind of just, you know, going off about things that weren't going good in her life, kind of complaining here and there, saying that things weren't going too well, and she was kind of feeling miserable. Keith, not being one to have any sort of compassion, didn't help the situation at all, and he coldly offers to end her life for her. He's like, if you're not feeling it, then why don't you just kill yourself? She kind of agrees, although I can't imagine she actually agreed, but within minutes, Keith said she was dead. Then came our newly identified victim, Patricia Patsy Skipple. Again, she was found May of 1993 in Gilroy, California. The remains of another Jane Doe were found September 1994 in Crestview, Florida. Then came the murder of Angela Sabreez, a 21-year-old who knew that Keith was a trucker. So she had asked Keith for a ride from Spokane, Washington to Indiana so she could meet up with her boyfriend. They had stopped in Nebraska so Keith can sleep through some bad weather, and he claims that while he was trying to catch his Z's, Angela kept waking him up and harassing him to drive through the bad weather. Keith said eventually he got sick of it, so he choked her to death and went right back to bed. He said he woke up fresh the next morning, ready to hit the road, but he didn't know what to do with her body and didn't want any chances of being caught. So he tied her to the undercarriage of his big rig and drove for miles while he dragged her underneath. What was left of her, he had dumped on the side of a road in Nebraska. This guy is so sick, someone needs to tie him to the undercarriage of a big rig and drag his ass for miles. So Keith's eighth and final victim was Julie Wingenham, a 41-year-old whose murder was much different than all of the others. Julie just wasn't a woman that he had picked up during his travels. She was actually his girlfriend. And her murder would lead to the fall of the Happy Face Killer, because Keith would be arrested and charged. And while communicating with his lawyer, Keith would go on to confess to all of the other murders as well. He said that he just needed to put this whole crime spree behind him and that he was tired of worrying about it. It was a lot of weight on his shoulders. And he said he wanted to be in jail in Laverne and John's place. He wanted to be the one serving time in jail for the murder that he had committed. He had kind of felt bad for John. He knew that John was in there and that he didn't have anything to do with her murder. Keith also told his attorney that there were approximately 175 others that he had killed along the way. I kind of believe him. I mean, it seemed like he could just kill somebody and literally just drop them and walk away and never turn back around. I do wonder if he's ever attempted to lead any investigators to like burial sites of where any other victims could be buried. Like, are there really more than just the 8? So in all of this, the insane part is that Keith would have never been suspected in any of these cases. Investigators had been searching for a suspect in Tanja's murder alone for weeks before Laverne came forward with her false confession. Keith literally flew under the radar in all of these murders. I mean, he could have possibly been caught because of the DNA advancements, but I mean, who knows? So there's only one victim that we know of that was able to bravely escape Keith's deadly hands. Her name was Dawn Slingle. Dawn had met Keith Jesperson in Mount Shasta, California, in a parking lot one night when she had went for a walk after a fight with her husband. Dawn had been out about 10 o'clock at night with her 4-month-old son when Keith walked up to her in freezing cold temperatures, inviting her back to his car with her baby to get them both out of the cold. Conversation between the two of them turned into touching and the two got physical. Keith had attempted to force himself onto Dawn and a struggle then ensued. Keith began doing what Keith does. He grabbed her head and started bashing her face into the window. She had been holding her baby on her lap, and the baby fell to the floorboard, screaming and crying. Dawn says that she knew that Keith was trying to kill him as he stomped with everything he had on the baby's body. After what seemed like forever, Dawn thought it would be a good idea to calm him down by maybe playing a mind game with Keith as if she was interested in him and gave him the attention that he wanted, and Keith actually fell for it. He had snapped out of the rage that he had flown into, started the car back up again, and began to drive. Well, the car ride was obviously super awkward. It was more quiet than quiet, and Dawn was so scared. So not a word is muttered by any of them until Keith says the following to Dawn, quote, "Don't ever get into a car with someone you don't know. It might be the last thing that you ever do." She's like, what the fuck? Get me out of here. Keith then pulls over the car and he lets her and the baby out. So he pulls away, leaving Dawn and the baby in the cold dark, and she eventually makes her way back home. She tells her husband what happened. He's a total jerk about the whole thing, placing all of the blame on her. And when she calls the cops to report the incident, her husband tells her not to press charges. And so she repeats this to the police, like, okay, you know, I'm home, I'm fine. No, I don't want to press charges. So she hangs up the phone and they're kind of in this verbal argument, altercation. And Dawn thinks to herself, like, no, forget this. Like, I want to press charges. What he did was not okay. He really scared me. He hurt me. He hurt my baby. So she picks the phone back up, calling the police, and they had arrested him already. They found Keith based on the description that Dawn had given. And Dawn tells them, hey, you know, I do want to press charges. And they're like, you know, we had him, we questioned him, and we already let him go. You told us you didn't want to press charges, and so he was free to leave. So what she didn't know was that police had questioned Keith about the incident with Dawn, which he was able to explain his way through the events as if the car ride altercation never even happened. Like, it was all a misunderstanding, or that Dawn was like delusional and maybe trying to frame him. and the police believed what he had to say. He was a free man. Dawn says that she lives with so much survivor's guilt that she should have done the right thing when she had the chance, pressing charges against Keith for that altercation in his car. And side note, I'm happy to note that Dawn has been separated and divorced from her husband for a very long time. She does not deserve any physical abuse or mental abuse from anybody. She deserves so much better. And I hope today she's happy and healthy and in an amazing relationship. When Keith was finally charged with Tanja's murder, John was released, and it had been 3 years at this point. 3 years that John had sat in a prison for a crime that he did not commit. 3 years that Laverne had been trying to get someone to believe every word that she had said was a lie. Can you imagine poor John? He could have spent 30 years to life behind bars because of crazy ass Laverne, which, you guys, this just happened in San Francisco. This guy spent 30 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Actually, 32 years. He was convicted back in 1990 or the 90s of killing a friend. Like, the system is so broken, and I guess so much evidence pointed in a different direction, yet he was the one that was thrown behind bars. He served 32 years that he will never get back. So although John was released, the judge denied a motion for Laverne to be released. Her conviction was not overturned. The judge said that he believed that although she was not the killer, Laverne's actions, persistence, and obsession with the case that landed her behind bars and knowingly allowed a killer to remain free for years, who went on to kill seven others, was truly her responsibility. The judge stated that if a jury of her own peers convicted her those years ago, then behind bars is where she belonged. And I feel like that's where she just needs to be. She's freaking crazy. And it's not like she was there for very much longer anyway. She was only given 10 years. So Keith had written a letter to the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department detailing the murder of Patricia Skipple back in 1993. He said that he picked her up in Corning, which is a small rural town up in Northern California. He says the two had chatted in his truck, they had lunch together before things became sexual, and he ended up killing her. It's like, why, sir? Why did you have to kill her? Keith said that after Patricia passed, he continued to drive with her body in the big rig for hundreds of miles before dumping her along Highway 152 near Casa de Fruta in Gilroy, California. That letter was written by Keith in his Oregon prison cell that he had been calling home for some number of years. This confession, because it included details not known to anybody, earned him an additional life term in prison, although Patsy had remained a Jane Doe for many years after that. Patsy's family believes that they know her best, and they said she probably just hopped into Keith's big rig simply for a ride, something that was kind of normal back then. Keith has been interviewed many times over the phone since he's been apprehended. But prison officials will not allow face-to-face interviews because they said that he likes the attention just a little too much. So in an interview with a nightly news station from prison, a very unremorseful Keith says that he's sorry for everything that happens, but he says this with zero emotion. He says he wished it all never happened and he wished he could go back and make it all peaches and cream. He said that he wishes also that everyone would just move on from all of it. And the 2020 reporter is just shocked by what he just said. She's like, did you just say you wish everybody would like get over it and move on? And he's like, yeah, it's done. It's over with. So she asks him, like, what if this was your daughter that was found lying on the side of the road? And he's like, well, I would hunt the killer down and I would kill them myself. And it's like, yeah, I believe him. He says that he was able to justify all of the murders when they occurred, but he cannot justify them now. And if he could do it all over again, he would. He would make better decisions and he wouldn't go down the path that he did. Melissa, Keith's daughter, says that she doesn't believe anything he says, not for one second, and he would absolutely not do anything different if he had the chance. And she believes that if he was released today, he would 100% kill again. Melissa said that growing up, she never once saw an ounce of the happy face killer in her dad. She said that her dad was a provider and that she knows that she was her father's pride and joy. She said that he did begin to make little inappropriate comments here and there, maybe when she was like in her teens, but she was so naive to it. She just believed that her dad was into true crime or into those magazines that he was reading. She said that never for a second would she ever think that her dad was the killer that he was. Keith is still alive today. He's 67 years old, serving 4 life sentences in an Oregon State Penitentiary with no possibility of parole. I want to personally say thank you to Santa Clara County for working so hard on Patricia Skipple's case, bringing her identity back and delivering that amazing news to her family. Thank you guys so much for joining me today on Those Murder Girls podcast. Please head over wherever you're listening now, leave me a 5-star review and some nice comments, and I will see you guys back here next Friday. Bye, guys.